Of course, today's topic is prospects for a diplomatic solution in Iran. If you've been watching TV this morning at all and the hearings in the House, they've been talking about Syria, but I did just see Duncan Hunter ask the secretary, saying he's got the wrong resolution on the floor. This resolution ought not to be for the authorization of use of military force against Syria. It ought to be used against Iran, to which he received a nice lecture about diplomacy and diplomacy with Iran, which, of course, we appreciated. And as you probably know, Secretaries Kerry and Hagel are founding fathers of this institution, along with Hart and Rudman and others. We are an educational institution, a 501c3. We are bipartisan. When we were founded, it was equal number of Republicans and Democrats. But obviously, we prefer diplomacy over the use of military force. And that said, our board is comprised of an equal number of Republicans, Democrats, businessmen and women, and military officers, and the military folks provide a national security perspective to all these issues, which I think is certainly critical to everything we're discussing today. On Iran, it's kind of been pushed a little bit off the topic today with Syria and what's going on there, but nonetheless, there is some daylight with the new election and moving over of who's going to handle the nuclear negotiations, and I think we'll get into that in some depth today. I am not an expert on Iran, but I have three who are here sitting to my right. What I intend on doing today is have each one of them address you for 10 to 15 minutes, and this is a bit longer than our normal session here. We usually run an hour. We're going to go an hour and a half till 2 o'clock, but I want to give each one of you gents an opportunity to speak your piece, and then what we'll do, we'll stop, perhaps have a short discussion. I'll turn it over to my director for nuclear security, Terry Lodge, and we'll do a Q&A. And on the Q&A, as I always say, the rules are I have a roving microphone. We will choose who will ask the question. If you ask a short question, please. And I first tell us who you are, ask a question, and then we'll handle that up front here. Let me introduce our three panelists. Greg Thielman, senior fellow at the Arms Control Association. He's served for more than three decades in the executive and legislative branches of government, specializing in political, military, and intelligence issues. And before joining ACA in 2009, he worked for 4 years as a senior professional staffer in the Senate Select Committee. And of course, he had a long, distinguished career in the U.S. Foreign Service. Greg will give an overview of Iran's nuclear program. Secondly, we'll have Joel Rubin. Joel is Director of Policy and Government Affairs for Plowshares, a former congressional aide and diplomat, worked for two senior Democratic senators on foreign policy, defense, and appropriations issues at state and in both Near Eastern affairs and political military affairs in state. He's won numerous awards. Joel will address possible diplomatic solutions with Iran. And last but not least will be Alizur Zira Nader. He's a senior international policy analyst with RAND and lead co-author of Coping with a Nuclearizing Iran, which was published in 2011. Ali will discuss the internal politics in Iran and their impact over the next several months. So with that, I will turn it over to Greg.
Thank you, Steve.
And is your mic
on? Yeah. Is the mic working? Okay, it sounds like it is. Okay. I'm going to try to set the stage for the subsequent policy-oriented discussions by updating you on the status of Iran's nuclear weapons capability. And in doing this, I'm a little worried about boring you, because the main outlines of what I say you have heard before. Iran is building more centrifuges to enrich uranium. Iran is enriching more uranium to levels of both 3.5% and 20%. Iran is introducing advanced centrifuges to enrich uranium more efficiently. Iran is reducing the time it would need to build a bomb if it decides to break out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is not allowing the International Atomic Energy Agency, which I will refer to as the IAEA, to adequately investigate the possible military dimensions of past activities, like the alleged high explosives testing at Parchin. And Iran is not complying with its notification obligations under the arrangements it negotiated with the IAEA for future facilities. But IAEA inspectors are still regularly visiting declared nuclear facilities, and they report that Iran has not diverted enriched uranium for military purposes from those facilities. And Iran continues to say good things about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and very bad things about nuclear weapons. So there are some encouraging elements here. Now I'm going to throw some numbers at you and in the process try to add some substantive background for our discussions of the negotiating challenge. And before I do that, let me just mention that I did bring a number of thumb drives that contain the Arms Control Association's Iran briefing book. They're in the back of the room there. And so if these numbers confuse you too much and you want to see them in writing, you will have easy access to that. U.S. intelligence officials still assess that Iran has not made a strategic decision to pursue nuclear weapons and does not yet have the necessary ingredients for breaking out quickly to build an effective nuclear arsenal. But its uranium enrichment capabilities are steadily improving, and progress on the heavy water reactor at Arak could open up a second route to producing fissile material for nuclear weapons. Most of the nuclear program status issues revolve around Iran's stockpile of low-enriched uranium hexafluoride. This reflects the fact that this gas, if further enriched to 90%+ U-235 isotope content, can be used for making the core of a nuclear weapon. The hardest part of making a nuclear bomb is assembling the necessary amount of fissile material. That's why experts refer to the fissile material as the long pole in the tent. With a significant stockpile of even low-enriched uranium, Iran has already completed most of the work needed to build a bomb. The latest IAEA report counts a total of more than 19,000 installed centrifuges in three facilities in two locations: the above-ground Natanz pilot fuel enrichment plant, the large underground Natanz fuel enrichment plant, and the deep underground Fordow fuel enrichment plant near Qom. Interestingly, while the number of installed centrifuges continues to grow, the number of those actually spinning and enriching fuel has not, growing only slightly over the past year from about 10,000 to 10,200. Iran's stockpile of 20% enriched uranium is one of the most proliferation-sensitive aspects of its nuclear program. Iran's claim that the 20% enriched material is necessary to provide fuel for its Tehran Research Reactor, and I will refer to that as TRR, is dubious, as the size of this stockpile already far exceeds any realistic estimation of Iran's needs to keep the TRR going. According to the August IAEA report, Iran has produced 372 kilograms of 20% material. However, Iran has converted approximately 185 kilograms of the 20% material from uranium hexafluoride gas to uranium oxide, a solid form suitable for fabricating the fuel plates needed for the TRR. This leaves Iran with 186 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium hexafluoride, well below the roughly 250 kilogram amount needed for enriching further to make a bomb's worth of fissile material. This threshold, you recall, was the red line literally drawn by Israel's Netanyahu. I should note in passing that Iran does have the capability to convert uranium oxide back to uranium hexafluoride in as little as 1 to 2 weeks, but a significant amount of wastage would occur in this process. Iran is currently installing advanced centrifuges, the IR-2M, to produce power reactor-grade uranium. As of the August IAEA report, Iran had just over 1,000 IR-2Ms installed at Natanz, and plans indicate it intends to install over 2,000 more in the coming months. While it's difficult to know how much more efficient these centrifuges are before they generate operational data, experts assess that a tripling or quadrupling in efficiency might be realistic. So this more advanced design could eventually have a significant effect on Iran's options for breaking out of the NPT to build bombs. In terms of constraining nuclear weapons breakout capabilities in the near and midterm, limiting the accumulation of surplus uranium hexafluoride enriched to 20% is the most urgent, but tying the 3.5% enriched stockpiles to actual power reactor needs is also important. Should Tehran decide to pursue nuclear weapons, it would use highly enriched uranium as the core of its arsenal, using both its nearly 7,000 kilograms of 3.5% enriched uranium hexafluoride and its 185 kilograms of 20% enriched UF6. To enrich further to weapons grade, Iran would have sufficient fissile material for approximately 4 nuclear weapons. Iran's progress on a heavy water reactor at its Arak nuclear facility raises an additional concern that in the future Iran could produce plutonium. When separated from the spent fuel, the plutonium could also be used in weapons. Although Tehran declared to the IAEA that the reactor will not become operational in early 2014 as originally intended, the agency noted that the reactor vessel is in place and Iran is working on fuel assemblies for the reactor core. Iran claims that the heavy water reactor will be used to produce medical isotopes, but it is ill-suited to that purpose and more suited for producing nuclear weapons fuel. Independent experts assess that if Iraq functions at optimal capacity, it could be used to produce sufficient plutonium to yield 9 kilograms annually after separation, enough for approximately 1.5 nuclear weapons. However, Iran does not have a reprocessing facility for separating the plutonium to produce weapons usable material. And Tehran maintains it does not intend to separate plutonium from the irradiated fuel that the reactor will produce. An additional dynamic that Iran must consider is Israel's history of bombing such facilities before they come online. In 2007, Israel bombed the heavy water reactor that Syria was constructing with help from the North Koreans. In 1981, Israel destroyed the Basirak reactor in Iraq. Unlike Fordow, the Arak facility is relatively vulnerable and Israel has the capability to strike it without assistance from the United States. But bombing a nuclear reactor after it becomes operational risks a catastrophic radiation release of Chernobyl-like proportions. Any comprehensive deal will need to take the Arak reactor into account. The P5 plus 1 should offer to replace the reactor with a light water design more suited to producing medical isotopes and less of a proliferation risk. Any discussion of Iran's options for building a nuclear arsenal would be remiss if it did not address how Iran would deliver the weapons to likely opponents. If Iran were to decide soon to build nuclear weapons, it would be likely to design them for delivery by Iran's operational liquid fuel medium-range ballistic missiles, the Shahab 3, or its later variant, the Ghadir 1. These missiles would be able to target U.S. bases in the region and urban areas in countries like Israel and Turkey. It is not known whether Iran has a warhead design ready to put on either missile, but there are doubts that it could fabricate one small enough for the longer-range Ghadir. A solid-fuel medium-range missile in development, the Sejil 2, would have slightly more range than the Shahab variants and would be more survivable, but it has apparently encountered technical problems, not having been flight tested now for more than 2.5 years. Unless Iran were working with a foreign warhead design that it had already been tested, it would also probably want to conduct its own proof test, meaning more time and more fissile material would be required to build and deploy the first weapon, and the world would have an unmistakable warning before it happened. Moreover, to pose a credible threat, Iran would need several warheads rather than a single bomb, further extending the threat timeline. In order to pose a threat to most of NATO Europe or any of the United States, Iran would have to deploy, to develop and deploy even longer range systems. And you've heard for years that from primarily strategic missile defense advocates, that this will occur in 2015. But 2015 is a worst case number the intelligence community has used for a long time, now requiring so many qualifications, it is no longer a meaningful projection. In fact, no Iranian intermediate range or intercontinental ballistic missiles have been seen or flight tested. So whatever red lines are drawn on cartoon bombs, Iran is not yet on the verge of being able to make a no-warning dash to nuclear weapons. But Iran is a nuclear weapons-capable state, which is not in full compliance with its obligations to the IAEA. So there are no grounds for complacency, particularly since there is no assurance that the United States will be willing to exploit the apparent political opportunity represented by the new Iranian government. The task now, as before, is to convince Iran that building nuclear weapons is not necessary for deterrence and is not in its national interest. Thank you.
Great, great comments. Appreciate that. Joel?
Thanks, General Cheney. Good afternoon, everyone. Wonderful to be here. Thank you to ASP, to Terry Lodge for putting on such an important panel. And I appreciate my colleagues here, Ali Nader and Greg Thielman, as well, for all of their work. And I'm happy to be engaging in this conversation with you and with them. And just before going into my remarks, I wanted to mention as well, tomorrow we're coming up on the anniversary, September 11th, both a year ago as well as a dozen years ago, we lost friends and compatriots, so I just wanted to put out a word of memory on their behalf, and hope that we can all continue to engage in these kinds of productive conversations about how to avoid those types of incidents. I wanted to talk a little bit today about diplomacy in Iran, and particularly in light of the debate about Syria that's going on, and try to think about these issues in a way that helps us to navigate this complicated issue that Greg just so ably outlined. And really, I think that it's important for us to stretch our minds about how we think about diplomacy, about how we think about resolving these thorny issues. And in particular, I want to touch on three strategic themes that I believe are present in the current Washington debate about Syria that are relevant to Iran policy. The first is, I know it's a cliche, but it's always darkest before the dawn when it comes to diplomacy. Just when one thinks we're at an end point, suddenly a new opportunity opens up. The second one is that presidents must push for results, but they have to see what their teams can deliver. It's not just the president that's engaged in diplomacy. And the third is that Congress can't be counted on, but it can't be ignored. So on the first one, regarding how it's darkest before the dawn, we need to remember that opportunities always present themselves for diplomacy. But diplomacy is not linear. And different pressures at key moments, combined with creativity, can produce results. Just when we think that windows are closed, new ones may open. And we need to ensure that we're searching exhaustively for those windows while recognizing that multiple interventions, it may be the threat of force, it may be sanctions, it may be cultural exchanges, that those could potentially make the difference. And for example, Secretary Kerry yesterday with Russia, clearly a hot topic of the moment in the news cycle, the question is, could this be one of those moments? Will the combined threat of military action and open diplomacy, a creative idea thrown out there, will that be the catalyst for a new opportunity to achieve our country's goals? We need to be open to that. And there's another creative example, and history is full of them. About 20 years ago, then Foreign Minister Shimon Peres went around the back of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin to engage with the Palestinians and set up the Oslo peace process. No one knows why. Rabin wasn't happy about it, but it worked, and it started Israel at that period on a path where they began to see some thaw in the relations with the Palestinians. So what about with Iran? Will it be the Twitter charm offensive that the new president, Rouhani, is engaged in, that he has in many ways captivated the imaginations of Washington and New York pundits and policy elites? Will it be a back channel that we're not aware of? Will it be the heightened tensions around Syria, perhaps? We need to keep our minds open on this. Now, the second point is that presidents must push for results and see what their teams can deliver. It's not all up to the president. The president is not the only individual in the United States government that can engage in diplomacy. Sometimes our government can make fatal decisions by choosing, in fact, to do nothing. And in particular, it's when subordinates to the president don't seize the moment to deliver for the boss. For example, when I was at the State Department during the Iraq War, after the invasion, I was shocked, and there was a lot of chatter in the building about how we had sent troops into Iraq, we had destabilized the Persian Gulf, and we had multiple issues with Iran, and yet the secretary wasn't going to Tehran. Why was that? Why did that not happen? Why was there no engagement of any sort with the key adversary in many respects to the United States in the region just at the same moment that we had troops on both of its borders? I don't understand why we refuse to talk to our adversaries. If anything, I think that we should be opening it up. For example, look at the interview from the other day that Bashar Assad gave. It was a bone-chilling interview if you watched it. Here in the US, at least through our media, we heard from him, we saw him, we listened to him. It didn't cost us anything. It exposed him for what he is, which is a brutal dictator full of lies and threats and bullying. And it only strengthened the administration's case for action. Now, it's easy to advance policies perceived to be tough, but what about taking the risk for policies that also advance our interests, but that may generate short-term political heat? That's a challenge to the president's team and to all presidents' teams. And that's where Iran comes in as well. On Iran, we may be coming to that moment where those entrusted by the president need to break open new opportunities, and they'll have to step out of their comfort zones to help the president achieve his goal of preventing an Iranian nuclear weapon. Now, third, the Congress can't be counted on, but it can't be ignored, is that we have to live with the fact that, yes, Congress is a co-equal branch of government with the executive branch. And President Obama was right, painful as it is, to go to Congress, and frankly, he had little choice. He would face Congress before or after, he's going to face Congress. So Congress may very well, despite its leaders' assurances of support, may vote down the president's request to authorize military force on Syria. I remember when I was in Congress during the Iraq debates, I was a Senate staffer. And I remember at that time, President Bush lost multiple votes about the Iraq war, be it on funding, be it on withdrawing troops. It didn't end his presidency. In fact, he ended up executing the surge and thumbing the nose of Congress. And it worked for him. It worked in the sense that he was able to execute it. Now, one thing we have to say is at least this president has put his faith in the system that the founders wanted, and it's gone to the people and the representatives, messy as it may be. So if the president loses on this vote, this likely won't be the end of his presidency, but it will severely weaken him. But he can recover. 3 years and 4 months is a lot of time, and that's what he has left on his watch in his presidency. On the other hand, I'm not so sure that the Syrian people will recover, and they may in fact just run in the face of failure to see further action of some sort that corrals the chemical weapons. So in the case of Iran, how does this play out? It may in fact, the Syria example may in fact make it harder for Iran to believe that President Obama can get a deal through Congress to repeal sanctions if he loses on the Syria vote. But then again, stranger things have happened. Did a little history checking last night. For example, Jimmy Carter got the Panama Canal Treaty through Congress in 1978, March and April, with 68 votes, 2 votes away from losing. It caused a severe political backlash, but he was still able to pursue international diplomatic agreements after it, including the Camp David Accords later that same year, and an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty the year after. And that was followed by congressional support. So in the end, American success with Iran will be directly impacted by what happens on Syria, but perhaps not in the way we think. A does not lead to B, and not always to C in diplomacy, and we should be skeptical of those who exude extreme confidence over how one particular action will lead to only one potential result. Perhaps military action against Syria could produce a breakthrough. We need to explore this. Perhaps the administration's multiple officials are stretching the boundaries of their lanes. Perhaps the mere act of facing our adversary, engaging the world, going to Congress, and talking to the public about Syria is conditioning us for a different approach towards Iran at the moment that the Iranians themselves are exploring this question. We should continue to keep in mind that these three strategic themes about the current Washington debate on Syria and how they impact Iran, being it's always darkest before dawn when it comes to diplomacy, presidents must push for results and see what their teams can deliver, and that Congress can't be counted on, but it can't be ignored, that all of this is relevant to Iran policy going forward. Thank you.
Joel, great comments. Ali.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Just want to talk about briefly another presidency, Nasser Rouhani presidency, which is in its infancy, but I think it does provide some real opportunities for the United States and its partners to resolve the nuclear crisis diplomatically. The first issue I want to address is, why is Rouhani even president? I think he was a complete surprise, not just for analysts and policymakers in the United States, but within Iran as well. The Iranian media and the US media didn't report him as being one of the favorite candidates of the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. But nevertheless, almost 52% of the voting population, the electorate, voted for him, those who voted. And out of eight candidates who were qualified by the Guardian Council, Rouhani was elected and didn't even go into the second round, got the majority of the vote. So yes, it was not a democratic election. In some ways, we can still say it was an engineered election, but the fact that the Iranian people voted for him and the fact that he's president is important, and I think it's very telling. What can we expect from him? I don't see Rouhani as a very transformative figure. I don't think he's interested in democracy in Iran. He's not a reformist. We have to see even if he releases some of the top reformist opposition leadership as he's promised. He's a conservative cleric. He helped create the Islamic Republic. He was at Ayatollah Khomeini's side when he led the revolution. He's been part of the national security establishment for more than three decades. He was Iran's national security advisor under former President Rafsanjani and former President Khatami for 16 years. So he's part of the system. He's not an outsider. And some in the United States have made the argument that because he's part of this system, we can't expect any major changes from him. And I would disagree. I think it's because he's part of the system that he can lead Iran through a diplomatic solution. And the president in Iran is important. Some other analysts have argued that, well, the supreme leader is all-powerful and the Revolutionary Guards control the Iranian political system. And there's no doubt that Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards exert a great amount of authority within the system. But the president constitutionally in Iran is the second most powerful figure. He gets to appoint the cabinet ministers. He appoints Iran's negotiation team. And he controls a pretty vast bureaucracy. He's responsible for the economy and economic planning. And all these things are very important. So we have to look at Rouhani's choices for his cabinet ministers, such as Javad Zarif, who's a relative moderate and a former Iranian ambassador to the United Nations. And when we look at Rouhani's choices, he's picked relatively moderate figures. Not in a reformist sense that they want to change the system, but figures who tend to be less ideological than former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's administration. What's happening in Iran today, after 8 years, essentially the Rouhani government is cleaning house. They're getting rid of diplomats, politicians, decision makers who were chosen by Ahmadinejad. And although there's a tendency in the United States to think, well, all these guys are the same, I think there are important differences between them on foreign policy. Rouhani and his advisors are less ideological on foreign policy issues. For them, they want to protect the Islamic Republic and its interests, but in a more pragmatic manner. And I think they are very open to diplomatic engagement with outside powers, even in the United States. How does Rouhani view the nuclear program? He believes in it. He believes in Iran's right to enrich uranium. As a nuclear negotiator, he negotiated with the EU3, the United Kingdom, Germany, and France in order to seize Iran's enrichment of uranium. and he saw that as a practical move. And Rouhani blames actually the United States to a certain extent for sabotaging that deal. But his support for the enrichment program doesn't mean that he's willing to support it at all costs. When Ahmadinejad was president, he described the nuclear program as a train without brakes. He thought that Iran was going to go forward with the nuclear program no matter what the costs were. And as we've seen in Iran today, the costs for the Islamic Republic and the Iranian people especially have been very high. And Rouhani is a figure who realizes the costs of Iran's nuclear pursuits. He realizes the costs of Ahmadinejad's policies, and I think he wants to retrench. He wants to step back and look at the policies Iran has pursued and see if they work. And the indications are he doesn't think that they have worked, and he wants to make important changes. And I think this is one of the reasons we're seeing positive signals from his government, whether it's the Twitter message congratulating Jews on Rosh Hashanah, adopting a softer line on Syria. And I think the softer line on Syria is very important. A week ago, former President Rafsanjani made a speech in Iran that caused controversy, and he talked about the Assad regime gassing its own people. And Rafsanjani, along with a number of other people in the Rouhani administration, have been critical of chemical weapons use because Iran experienced it during the Iran-Iraq war. Iranians have suffered greatly from it. But I think Rafsanjani talking about chemical use is very important because the Islamic Republic up to this point has maintained that only the Sunni opposition in Syria has used chemical weapons. It hasn't been willing to acknowledge that Assad has chemical weapons and has used them. So Rafsanjani's speech demonstrated the deep divisions within Iran on foreign policy, especially Syria policy. And Rafsanjani is a very close backer of Rouhani. I think Rafsanjani is actually one of the motivating forces behind the Rouhani administration's foreign policies. If you look at Rouhani's inauguration, the whole time Rafsanjani is sitting next to him, beaming, completely happy. And a reason for this is he got his revenge. I mean, Ahmadinejad was not able to diminish him completely from the Iranian political system. So I think all of this gives the United States an opportunity. And Joel talked about stretching our imagination. I think at this point, given the critical U.S. national security interests at stake, it is important to think about some other alternatives. Even if the United States goes ahead with military force in Syria, I would argue that really the only solution to the Syrian crisis is a diplomatic solution, a diplomatic settlement between the sides fighting in Syria, but also the countries that are backing them, including the United States, Russia, but also importantly, Iran. I think there's a tendency to focus on the Russian role in Syria, but Iran is a critical player in Syria. I would argue more critical than Russia. And I have a very hard time imagining a political settlement in Syria without some role for Iran. And I think there's a natural aversion to this in Washington, D.C. But given the stakes in Syria, especially now, I think it's something to consider. Indirect or direct engagement with Iran on the Syria issue. So just to summarize, Rouhani may not be the ideal interlocutor for the United States. He's not a Democrat. If I had been voting in Iran, I personally would not have voted for him or any of the candidates. But I think in looking at US policy options, we have to look at our interests and our ability to achieve our interests very pragmatically. I think Tehran is showing that it can be pragmatic, and I think we have to demonstrate we can be pragmatic as well. Thank you.
Ali, great comments. Before I turn it over to Terry, I've got 1,000 questions, and I'm sure everybody else in here does as well. But let me just ask you about sanctions, your opinion of sanctions and their impact on Iran, and calls from some to increase them, others to let them stay the way they are, others to let them lessen them, and Rouhani's opinion about those.
Right. So, and I think there are two reasons really why Rouhani was elected and the regime allowed him to be elected, because the Guardian Council disqualified Rafsanjani, but Rouhani got through the process. And I think the two reasons are that the regime faced an internal crisis in Iran, especially the divisions after the 2009 presidential election. It was very important for Khamenei and the system to try to bridge some of the gaps between the system, because Khamenei realizes he needs national unity, or at least unity within the Islamic Republic. And before the election, Khamenei made a very interesting speech in which he said, I urge all Iranians to go and vote. Even if you don't accept the Islamic Republic as Iran's legitimate system, go and vote. And this is the first time, according to my recollection, that he's even talked about Iranians who do not accept the Islamic Republic and should go vote. So Rouhani is meant to bridge that gap between the system. But I think more importantly, in some ways, he wants to get rid of the sanctions, because the regime realizes that U.S. and international sanctions against Iran are an existential threat. And Rafsanjani has been saying this for years. Rouhani has been saying this for years. For them, lifting sanctions and getting Iran back to a major oil exporter is priority number one. And so I think this gives a lot of leverage for the United States to negotiate with Iran. If you ask me, sanctions have a lot of terrible effects. They have terrible effects on the population, especially in the long term. But they have provided leverage for the United States. And so we have this opportunity to use the leverage we built up to negotiate with the Iranian government. Now, to increase sanctions now before we've engaged with Tehran doesn't make any sense to me. Because what could happen, As I said, I think Rouhani has been given a chance by the establishment to negotiate his way out of the crisis. But if the Islamic Republic of Khamenei, the Revolutionary Guard, some of the more conservative figures, see that despite Rouhani's efforts, the United States keeps imposing sanctions on Iran, then the window for negotiations could close. And I don't think we're at a point, I think there's people in Washington, D.C. who think that if we impose enough sanctions against the Islamic Republic, somehow the regime will implode, there will be a regime change, Democrats will take over. I don't know really what the vision behind this is, but I don't think we have enough time to have those sort of hopes, because yes, Iran is not close to a dash of nuclear weapons breakout capability, but it's getting closer and closer. And I think even with a total cutoff and oil exports, the regime in Iran could last a few more years, if not longer. So I think the time to negotiate with Iran is now. We have the leverage, we're in a good position, and we should take advantage of it.
Joel?
Sure, General. I'd like to add to that as well, which the Obama administration has consistently argued that sanctions are about sharpening the choices of Iran's rulers and making it clear to them about a cost-benefit equation that they need to take into account. And so what Ali just described in many ways is the natural outcome of that type of policy, where choices are starting to be made. And I think from a domestic perspective, there are so many sanctions bills, one can't even keep track of them, that are consistently offered on the Hill. And right now we're looking at some larger sanctions vehicles on the Hill. Some of them, however, include language that, frankly, would handcuff the president's ability to negotiate a diplomatic deal with Iran on its nuclear program. And in particular, sanctions bills that do not include the ability of the president to waive certain sanctions. That makes it very difficult for a near-term confidence-building arrangement on the 20% enriched material that Greg highlighted to come about. So that's where we'll probably see a lot of the debate. We're going to see other debates likely this fall about authorizing military force potentially on Iran. But when it comes to sanctions, we've got three decades worth of sanctions piled up currently on Iran, multiple UN Security Council resolutions governing them on the petroleum sector, on the banking sector, related to the nuclear program, related to human rights violations, related to Iranian support for terrorism, you name it, it's there. And the key question going forward is, will the president and his team, if they engage in a negotiation on real substance, have in their minds enough flexibility to move on sanctions relief that will keep the Iranians at the table and get a deal that can be verifiable? And then going further, can they deliver on, and I think what Ali highlighted, Rouhani's, in a sense, promise to the Iranian people, which is to get rid of sanctions, and that's a much bigger fight. And that is, as we're seeing now, wrapped into the Syria debate as well. So we're going to be seeing quite a lot of activity on this in the fall.
And I think I would just agree with my colleagues here that additional sanctions are not the way to go right now. They not only wouldn't help that much, but they would have the potential to do great harm in our relations with other countries. I would also just add parenthetically that we should also appreciate some of the benefits of sanctions in terms of making it difficult for Iran to develop its both nuclear program and also its missile program. Iran has done certain things in a way that is not the most efficient way or the most productive way because they can't get the materials because of the sanctions that have been imposed. And another thing that is almost completely overlooked, the UN Security Council sanctions also include major military systems sent to Iran. And Iran, up to that point, was dependent from foreign suppliers for certain kinds of weapon systems. So also a little notice of the fact that Iran's military is really kind of decaying over time, and that is in very great part due to the sanctions. So the sanctions have given leverage, they've slowed programs down that we have great concerns with, but as Joel emphasized, the waiver authority is critical here, and my biggest worry about sanctions is that we don't know how to shift it into reverse. We can make a proposal to the table, and I worry that we can even follow through on the proposal and deliver the reduction in sanctions because of the way sanctions have been operated. We've seen evidence of that in the past. And so I think for people thinking seriously about the next step in the negotiations and offering sanctions, it almost all involves offering to reduce European sanctions, because we don't know how the hell we're going to reduce American sanctions.
Wow. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Terry Lodge, our Director for Nuclear Security.
Thanks, General. Thanks, everyone. Great discussion. I'll take Steve's name tag off. thanks, everyone. It was a great discussion. We'll take your questions now. Yes, sir. Could you identify yourself?
Well, I have built-in microphone, thank you.
Are you sure?
I mentioned to Mr. Tillman that I'm the former director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, supervisor of the 5-megawatt research reactor, and I made it protocol in 67. I'm an American, so what I'm gonna say is in total as a professional scientist. With all due respect, sir, you have 3-4 errors in your presentation. One, and you mentioned, it's honest, it's not a nuclear scientist, but I am. Under NPT, Iran can have 19,000 or 19 million centrifuges. And literally, it's nobody's business. Two, the GOM, Purdue Enrichment Facility, is in 100% compliance. This is for you people. Because, you know, mass media kind of misinforms us. Why? Because Iran's parliament never ratified additional protocol called 3.1. Iran, Fordow, they informed IAEA September 9, 2009, a few days before the Pittsburgh conference, Sarkozy, Gordon Brown. Whether GOM facility is underground, above ground, in the sky, is in 100% compliance with original NPT. The world says Iran should comply with additional protocol. Maybe they should. Maybe they shouldn't. So, that statement, sir, is incorrect. Number two, I have operators in the 5-megawatt reactor whom I train. I'm a reactor operator, licensed by US government. They have used 23 fuel assemblies, MTR we call it, from the 20%. And if that plant reactor goes down, thousands die because Iran needs the radioisotopes. It's for humanitarian reasons. And the world denies them because of sanctions. Iran cannot buy technetium from Canada because the US government says don't do it. Humanitarian. So the fact that Iran can pile up another million ton of 20% for whatever use they want, true. Iran's leadership, I've said this 10 times to universities, to UN Security Council, Iran's leader have not made the decision to build nuclear weapon. But Admiral Mullen and CIA and US government says he's 1 to 2 years away. I've heard this for the past 30 years. They have not made the decision. In America, the president made the decision, we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Sir, I will be more than happy, and I respect you tremendously and your organization, to come and talk to you people. I'm an American, I'm an Iranian, but I'm a scientist, not a politician.
Thank you. Greg, would you like to respond preliminarily?
Yeah, I think I'm in violent agreement with almost everything you've said.
Then why did you say it?
So, I think you may have misunderstood what I said. For example, on whether or not Iran can have an infinite number of centrifuges, there's nothing in the NPT that says Iran cannot have an infinite number of centrifuges. We're taking the, I'm looking at where we are today in light of the fact that Iran has lost or has not been able to gain the confidence of the IAEA that it has no military programs. And one of the reasons is because Iran is not abiding by what it agreed to do on, for example, Code 3.1 notification to the IAEA. Iran just unilaterally said, well, we decided not to do that. That's not acceptable. It's a two-party agreement, IAEA and a country. You can't unilaterally say we've decided not to follow through on the commitment
Mr.
that we've already made.
It's a voluntary agreement, sir.
Thank you.
So anyway, that's one point. And then on the other point, sir, the humanitarian nature of the TRR and medical isotopes, as you, I'm sure, know, a number of proposals have been made that would allow not only the TRR to continue, but to provide help in building other facilities for medical isotopes. So, I think that I understand some of the reasons for your problems with the way this material is often presented, but I think that
thanks, Greg.
It's not applying to what I've
Barbara?
Said. Barbara Simon from the Atlantic Council. Thanks, guys, for your presentation. Syria is the elephant in the room, and Joel, I appreciated the way you handled it, but my concern is after all the twists and turns we've seen out of the Obama administration over the last couple of weeks, what do you think, what impact do you think this is going to have on nuclear negotiations with Iran? What are Iranian leaders making of this debate? Are they encouraged that the United States is unlikely to resort to military action against any country in the region after watching what's been going on? Could that help negotiations in a way? Or do you think that that might not embolden Iran to build a bomb, but embolden Iran to seek an even better deal somehow in even tougher negotiations than they otherwise would be? Or is it irrelevant? Are they two different situations? How should we look at it?
So, Ali, do you want to tag team that? You go to Iran. I think there's a legitimate prognostication about what does this mean for Iran. And we're seeing it, frankly, in the lobbying over the authorization for use of military force, the messaging, the lobbying, whatever way one wants to describe it, which is that essentially the framing is the United States needs to stick to this red line about the use of chemical weapons for fear of and the danger of, if it doesn't, Iran won't take the American red line seriously. On nuclear weapons. I would argue that the president's red line on chemical weapons was, and frankly the global red line on chemical weapons, but the way the president stated was very overt and very clear, and he has also argued about Iran, but not in as clear a way about a red line. He said no acquisition of a nuclear weapon. And to digress a bit, there's been a big debate for the past couple of years about Iran's nuclear program? Shall they have a capability, per what Greg said they already do, or shall they acquire a nuclear weapon? Now, the president's been arguing acquisition of nuclear weapons is his red line, but he has not phrased it in that specific way. But the issue of credibility, in fact, may not necessarily resonate in Tehran as much as it will in Riyadh or in Tel Aviv. It's clear that in the region, every action by the United States is read, reread, and reread again, and looked at from every possible angle. So for those whose security is directly tied to American security guarantees, which are significant, robust, and necessary, and historic, it's going to be very troubling for those countries to see the United States move back from a clear national security argument and commitment that the president has verbalized. So I think that that would create different reactions potentially in third-party countries, not necessarily, and I defer to Ali on how Tehran will read this.
So I think that Syria has demonstrated that the American public is tired of war. But this is not a big secret, and everybody knew this before Syria, and the Iranian government knew it before Syria. If you look at their statements for the past 10 years, they've been saying that Iraq and Afghanistan have been very costly for the United States, and the United States is unlikely to take military action against Iran because of that experience. They've been really saying this for the last 10 years. So it's not anything new. I think the United States not striking Syria militarily may reinforce that. I don't necessarily think that's a justification for striking Syria. There has to be a better rationale for it. And I really don't believe that the Iranian government is as vulnerable to the US military threat as is the Syrian regime, because Iran is a bigger power, has deterrent capabilities, it can interfere with shipping in the Persian Gulf and retaliate against the US in other ways. I mean, not that the United States can't destroy the Iranian military, but I think it's more of an equal battle than the US striking Syria. So I'm not sure that US military option towards Syria is critical in Iran's viewpoint. I think they're much more worried about sanctions than anything else. And that's the main US leverage toward Iran, not whether we strike the Syrian government or not. I think the Rouhani government wouldn't be surprised if the United States attacked Syria if there were limited strikes. I think some Iranian officials could tolerate it. I mean, they would not want the United States to attack Syria, but also they realize that a red line has been crossed. And my biggest concern is not so much how Iran reads U.S. action or the lack of a U.S. military response, but how do our allies view it? I think reassurance is a critical piece here. How do the Israelis view it? How do the Saudis view it? And I think we should be much, much more concerned about their behavior going forward. I think if there's a possibility that the U.S. can punish the Assad regime somehow, and doesn't have to be through military means, it can be the Assad regime supposedly giving up chemical weapons. I think that could be a victory for the United States, that there's a political settlement. That could help reassure our allies, but I think the United States needs to be viewed as being assertive on this issue, because if we're not, then the likelihood of our allies taking independent action in the Middle East goes up. And I'm not sure if that would be helpful for our overall policy toward Iran and the nuclear program.
Thank you.
Yes. Could I just add one thing?
I
think
Brian.
We are unfortunately missing an opportunity here in the way that we're handling Syria to slightly change the narrative in Tehran. It's my impression the supreme leader and many parts of the Iranian government are completely convinced that the U.S. objective here is to change the regime in Tehran, that is what everything is ultimately about, whether it's U.S. policy on CW or U.S. policy on nuclear weapons. So unfortunately, we are missing the chance to say that, well, actually, the United States regrets the fact that we watched Iraq gas Iran for 8 years, creating tens of thousands of fatalities, that we watched Halabja being gassed by Saddam's forces, three times as many people as killed on August 31st. And the U.S. at that very time was helping the people who were doing the gassing. So from Tehran, this does not look like the U.S. really cares about chemical weapons. So now would be a chance for us to say, well, we regret that, and we really do care about chemical weapons, and we have that in common with the Iranian government. But we're not doing that. Instead, we're going to Congress and saying, you know, if you authorize military force, we can really stick it to the Iranians. We can really make credible the threat that we will attack Iran if they start developing nuclear weapons. All of this plays exactly into the Khamenei view of the world. That's what the U.S. is actually about, and the CW is just another excuse. So I think there's a different way to do it, and in the interviews that Obama gave yesterday, I think he gets close to that by acknowledging that Iran suffered greatly under a CW attacks over an 8-year period, but we need to do more of that.
Well, I'm gonna just do a quick two-finger challenge on that, because I think that it's a little more nuanced in terms of the messaging that we're hearing coming from the White House. I think Jay Carney, about a week and a half ago, talked about how this is not about regime change towards Syria. This is limited. There are limited strikes. There is no military solution. There's a lot of code in there. I don't believe that we can expect a full pivot on the language, but at least reading between the lines and seeing different reporting about, for example, Jeff Feltman, the Undersecretary for Political Affairs of the UN, former senior foreign service officer at State, heading to Tehran, I think it's Sultan Qaboos, also doing some meetings as well. This type of messaging, these are, in a way, reinforcing the idea that the U.S. is not interested in going overboard in this situation with Syria. So we have to read between the lines to see what's really happening, which I think there may be more out there than we have access to.
In the front there, sir.
Milton Honigga, the International Center for Terrorism Studies. When Rouhani was the chief nuclear negotiator in the second term of Khatami, he was also the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, which has been tradition. Apparently that is some very conservative elements in it. Perhaps the Revolutionary Guard Corps is very influential there. Now suddenly you see a turnaround in which the appointment of the chief nuclear negotiator is given over entirely to the Foreign Secretary Zarif. Now, what is the significance of that? Is that good or bad? And I might put a footnote here. I saw Ray Taki the other day say that's a bad idea. So people are saying all the time that that's a good idea. Here someone said it's a bad idea. What do you think?
Why did he say it was a bad idea?
I didn't explain. I
think it's a good idea, actually, because you take it out of the National Security Council, which has several figures on the council, and you have one point person who's able to engage the United States and the international community. You know, the National Security Advisor in Iran is responsible for more than just the nuclear file. He has other duties, whereas a foreign minister can focus on the nuclear issue. And I think it's not so much that it's the foreign minister, but it's that Javad Zarif, who has lived in the United States for 3 decades, speaks fluent English, is known to senior figures within the United States, Ambassador Jim Dobbins, who's now the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, worked with him extensively. He knows him very well. And if you read his writings, he thinks well of him. So I think that the fact that Javad Zarif is the lead negotiator is more important than that it's the foreign minister, the national security advisor. And I think Rouhani didn't view the National Security Council as being a particularly efficient vehicle for conducting nuclear negotiations. And I don't have proof for this, but I think if it's Javad Zarif, he reports directly to Rouhani and in some ways bypasses Khamenei. And so this is, in some ways, arguably Rouhani's attempt to monopolized nuclear negotiations under his authority rather than having it open to other figures, including the Supreme Leader.
Okay. Anyone else? All right, well, I have one last question for everyone, and that is, in the next few weeks, how do you think the United States is communicating with Iran over the Syrian issue, and if it is, what do you think it's saying?
There's a chance where perhaps two ships may not pass in the middle of the night in New York at the UN General Assembly in a couple of weeks. President Rouhani and President Obama are scheduled to speak on the 25th, both of them at the UN. So who knows what will happen then? And I think we're going to see the Syrian debate drag on a little longer than people expected maybe a day ago. And the UN will get a little more involved in the game next week. So there are going to be multiple opportunities. And then you throw into the mix Catherine Ashton, the P5+1 getting re-energized, Rouhani talking about that as well. There are multiple opportunities for direct, indirect, and triangular diplomacy over the next few weeks on this to see if they can start getting a process going. I think there's a general recognition in Washington, at least, that there is not a limited time to see some progress in negotiations. Now, maybe Syria's delayed it a bit. Prior to the chemical weapons attack, people were talking about the fall. That tends to be how people view things here, several month snippets. But again, that does seem to be holding that. If nothing can be achieved after all this change inside Tehran and the changes in the region over the next few months, then it's going to put a big damper on the enthusiasm of renewed diplomacy.
Thank you all very much for coming. Thank our panel.
Thank you.
Here.